From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Master storyteller Ray Bradbury passed away this week at age 91. A wildly prolific author, he was the man behind Fahrenheit 451, Something Wicked This Way Comes, Dandelion Wine, and much more. His work pulses with Martians, Electronic Lions, Sinister, Mexican Mummies, The Joy of Childhood Summer, and above all, a deep love of the written word. This hour on Point, we remember the great Ray Bradbury. You can join the conversation. What have you read by Bradbury? Fahrenheit 451, The Martian Chronicles? What touched, what inspired, what terrified you? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook, On Point Radio. And later this hour, another treat, we'll hear some of a commencement address at Bennington College by actor Peter Dinklage, who some of us know better as Tyrion Lannister, Game of Thrones. But first, two great guests who are with us from our member station in Chicago, WBEZ, this hour to talk about Ray Bradbury. Sam Weller is professor of fiction writing at Columbia College in Chicago. He's known Ray Bradbury for 12 years, and he's the author of The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, and Listen to the Echoes, The Ray Bradbury Interviews. He's also co-editor of the upcoming anthology, Shadow Show, All New Stories in Celebration of Ray Bradbury, out in July. Sam Weller, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jackie. It's a pleasure to be here under very sorrowful circumstances.
Indeed, sorrowful. And also with us is Gary Wolfe. He's professor of humanities at Chicago's Roosevelt University, nearby Columbia College. He's an award-winning science fiction editor, critic, and biographer, and his latest book is Evaporating Genres, Essays on Fantastic Literature. Gary Wolfe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us. I'm very glad to be here.
Sam, let's begin with you, because you did know Ray Bradbury personally for over a decade and have written so much. Tell us what comes to mind when you think about him.
Speaking from a personal point of view, it's his spirit. I think that with his departure, it's interesting, he passed away at the same time that Venus was in transit across the sun, and his soul was in transit. We're losing a shining beacon, not only in literature, but in creativity and in hope. This is a very hopeful man, a man who celebrated life to the nth degree, and to say goodbye to him, the world loses something very, very magical and hopeful.
Sam Weller, have you been reflecting, I'm sure you have, this week on just what it is that made Bradbury not only as prolific and huge as he has been, but as beloved as he has been?
Gary, I really Wolf? Have. Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me when I was first thinking about being on the show is I write for a magazine, and I've done a lot of obituaries and appreciations for writers. And what you usually do is you go back and try to remember what you've said. And I didn't want to do that. And I found myself having the same reaction that I think a lot of other people had. I wanted to just remember. I think Bradbury is all about remembering. And I happen to be of a generation that can not quite remember the first books when they came out, but can certainly remember discovering him. An old tattered paperback of The Illustrated Man, which I picked up at a used bookshop. First science fiction I ever read. And then years later, I realized that what was unusual about this is it was probably the first science fiction that paid any attention to the prose, to the beauty of the writing. Mm-hmm. And he managed to maintain that amazingly over a long career. And I remember when I was a teenager, I was looking forward to his big novel, the one mainstream novel that he'd been promising for years, called Something Wicked This Way Comes, which, as a matter of fact, is published 50 years ago this month.
Mm. What drew you to him, Sam? Gary talked about The Illustrated Man. Was there a book? Was there a scene, an encounter? What?
You know, it's very funny. It's the same book. He's written so many books and 600 published short stories. But that book, my father was a Bradbury lover, like so many were, particularly in the baby boomer generation. Bradbury was discovered, I think, by the GIs of World War II in the pages of Pulp Fiction. He started his career writing in the Pulp Fiction magazines. And then after that, his books started coming out in the 50s and was discovered by the boomers. And My dad loved Bradbury, and when my mom was pregnant with me during the blizzard in Chicago of January 1967, he plucked the aforementioned frayed paperback copy of The Illustrated Man off of his bookshelf and read that book to my mom. He read it aloud, and I've often laughed, and Ray loved this story. He thought it sounded like a Bradbury story in and of itself. He read the frightening tales of the Illustrated Man to a poor pregnant woman in her third trimester. You hear the stories of playing classical music to a child in utero and its possible connection to brain development. I don't know what the brain development was that occurred with me, but I stand here all these decades later as his biographer. So it was definitely the Illustrated Man.
Definitely had an effect. Well, I would like to play a clip now from Bradbury on being a writer. This was in a short film made about him in 1963, and he's talking about a lecture about something I really love, about the enthusiasm required to be a writer.
You've got to be inspired and mad and excited and love it more than anything else in the world. And the hell with the relatives, and if any girl doesn't like what you're doing, out of your life. And if any of your friends, male friends, make fun of you, the hell with them. Out, out. And then but you get rid of all the relatives at once, immediately. No more Thanksgiving dinners. But it has to be this kind of, I've got to do it. I've simply got to do it. And if you're not this excited, you can't win.
You know what really surprised me about that? I was thinking that if I had just seen the quote of that, just the printout, which of course we see here, I would have thought that maybe it was someone more like Jack Kerouac speaking or Joseph Heller, someone who I really think of as edgy. And this is really kind of a radical statement, guys, you know, just throw everything out and write.
Sam? I think that he Sam, go ahead.
Go.
All right.
I was deferring to Gary there, but he was a radical guy in many ways. Fahrenheit 451 it was perceived for its time as an indictment of McCarthyism and Cold War era America and the communist witch hunt and all those things. Bradbury was to the very end an outspoken man, unafraid to share his thoughts and infuriate people. But he did it always from a point of love. It was never there was really no malice in the man. It was always he might say something that was controversial, but it came from an immense point of passion.
I think there are a couple of things related to that. One is that I only met him a couple of times. I mean, Sam, you've known him quite a while, but he was the picture of ebullience. I mean, he is the definition of ebullience, and every time he talked, he sounded like that. But early in his career, he wrote some very disturbing horror stories. In fact, that was his first collection, Dark Carnival, was very edgy and very disturbing in a way that surprises some people who came to him through Dandelion Wine and these celebrations of childhood and so forth.
And Gary, I apologize for stepping on there a moment ago. You know, you just mentioned Dandelion Wine. That's how I came to him. I'm a baby boomer, and boy, oh boy, I read it outside. I was picking dandelions. I was about 10 while I was doing it, and I thought, this is it. I'm going to pick a dandelion for every day of my life. Another scene that I love from his career is that he moves as a young man from Waukegan, Illinois, to Los Angeles with a family detour elsewhere in the Southwest, and suddenly he's in the bosom of all these great science fiction writers, like Asimov and Heinlein, all meeting out there in L.A.
You know, when he was in high school, he had graduated and was really a bit rudderless. He didn't have enough money to go to college. His father was a utility line worker, and the Bradbury family was down and out. His father was regularly in and out of employment, and Ray saw a flyer posted in a magazine stand in Hollywood. It had been placed there by another famous person named Forrest Ackerman, who's a name that may ring a bell, founder of Famous Monsters magazine,
right,
and really coined the term sci-fi, considered to be the first fanboy by many. And Bradbury, it was a flyer for a group that gathered at a cafeteria in downtown Los Angeles called Clifton's Cafeteria, and Bradbury went there hoping to find a community. And he did indeed find that community. You just spoke of it. Robert Heinlein was a part of that, along with his wife. Ray Harryhausen, the great special effects animator, who's, you know, really considered the godfather of stop-motion animation, was a part of that. Ray discovered his mentor there, Lee Brackett, who went on to be a screenwriter for Howard Hawks, and she was a novelist and short story writer in her own right. So he really found a community. I remember him telling me about standing over Robert Heinlein's shoulder and watching him type his stories, and what a magical experience that was. And these people all perceived him as sort of the young one of the bunch. Bradbury was ebullient, as Gary said, and obnoxious, some of them felt. But he was hungry for this career. He wanted this career, and by God, he made it happen.
Yeah. Really transcended the genre, I think. Someone said he really put the fiction into writing about science fiction. And Gary, I want to talk a little bit more. Would you agree? I mean, genres are your specialty.
I always hesitant about the term transcended the genre, because the genre, by now, science fiction has transcended itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bradbury can be credited with a large part of that. He published a very early story, I think only one, in The New Yorker, and it was not a science fiction story. But before anybody else was doing this, there were other science fiction writers. Heinlein would publish in the Saturday Evening Post. Jack Finney, who's best remembered for Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But Bradbury was in Charm and Mademoiselle and travel magazines. And now, here we are 60 years after his New Yorker story, with The New Yorker devoting an entire issue to science fiction.
This is On Point, and I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking about science fiction legend Ray Bradbury. We're joined this hour by Sam Weller, biographer of Ray Bradbury, and by Gary Wolfe, science fiction editor and critic, both with us from Chicago. And here's a web comment from onpointradio.org from Jim Castronovo. I read Fahrenheit 451 in 7th or 8th grade. It was the book that put me marching down the road of critical thinking, and I haven't stopped since. Thank you, Ray. Send us your tributes and comments about Ray Bradbury. And let's hear another one he had on the meaning of life. In a public interview at Point Loma Nazarene University in 2001, Bradbury spoke about what he saw as the purpose of life.
There's no use having a universe, is there? There's no use having a billion stars. There's no use having a planet Earth if there isn't someone here to see it. You are the audience. You are here to witness and celebrate. To witness and celebrate. And you got a lot to see and a lot to celebrate. That's your business. You put it in your work. You put it in your stories. Otherwise, get the hell out and get out of our way and let us live, huh?
Sam Weller, another really amazing exhortation. As his biographer, we were speaking, and Gary mentioned a moment ago his ebullience. Witness and celebrate. What great words to live by.
That's Ray Bradbury. He loved living. In the last few years, as he really became more frail, I've visited him since my first book came out on him. I've gone to see him at his home about once a month. I just saw him in April, and I asked him on one of these recent trips if he was afraid of death. And he looked at me very defiantly, that same ebullience, that same defiance, that same celebration. And he said, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of not living.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a comment here. Peter is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Peter.
Yes, hello. I think for me, that it returns to what the person said online, and that is the enormous power of Fahrenheit 451. And that it is that even when it was written back in the 50s, after the Second World War, it is such a cautionary tale. It's not just a book burning, but it's about the burning of ideas. It's about the burning of differences and the insistence that things somehow be all alike. And I also would take note that Truffaut picked up on this, I thought, in the film beautifully, both with the music of Bernard Herrmann, but also that at the very end, there's snowfall, that totalitarian world somehow manages to go on. But there's the sense, you know, that books will be finally published and printed again, and that they will be there to speak what they know. And there's just such caution in this, especially in these times, I think.
And
Bradbury picked up on that so well. Also in the technology, where he loathed cell phones and people being endlessly distracted and, you know, not paying attention to the world around them, where you're staring in the in your palm of your hand and the future's coming straight at you, you know?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I know. Thank you, Peter, very much for that comment. You know, also, Gary, he jumped the boundaries of not only literature, but we were just talking about Fahrenheit 451, also such a great movie in Truffaut's hands with Oscar Werner, Julie Christie, and others. So adaptable, so protean.
I think I don't think Bradbury has generally been well served by the movies. There was a Rock Hudson TV miniseries of the Martian Chronicles that we don't want to talk about too much, but Truffaut was the right sensibility for him. Truffaut, I think it's a beautiful film. I think Oscar Werner and Julie Christie were well cast in it, and I think it very much got at the theme and updated the theme a little bit. One of the things that always the Bradbury used to talk about why we have science fiction is that he was writing Fahrenheit 451 and The Fireman and the stories that preceded it out of the era of the House Un-American Activities Committee, out of the era of McCarthyism. And he knew that were he to attack McCarthyism directly in mainstream fiction, he'd get in trouble. But writing science fiction, he could talk about very contemporary events in very powerful ways where the goons wouldn't notice he was doing it.
Hmm. Yeah. Let's take another call here. Leslie is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Leslie.
Hi, Jackie. I just wanted to call and tell a little story. I learned to love Ray Bradbury from my brother and my father. I remember we had a huge book of his short stories, and I read it a million times. But my brother especially loved him and wrote him a letter, probably when he was in high school. And he sort of said something along the lines of, I don't know why I'm writing this letter, but... And he got a beautiful personal letter back from Ray Bradbury that he still has framed and on his wall. And he just, it was in the era of typewriters. It was typewritten. It was personally signed by him. He had written it on Halloween. He drew a little pumpkin at the top. And it just said, you're writing me a love letter, and I really appreciate it. I know why you wrote me. You know, it was a love letter, and you know, it's very, you know, it was very meaningful.
How old was your brother? He was in high school. I mean, so he was a teen.
He was in high school at the time.
And he didn't mind being told this is a love letter?
No, because it was very tongue-in-cheek. It was just sort of his way of saying, you may not know why you wrote me, but you wrote me because you appreciate what I do, and I appreciate that you appreciate my work. So it wasn't. It was just sort of very Ray Bradbury. I think very tongue in cheek, a little bit.
Okay.
A little mischievous.
Thank you, Leslie. Thanks so much. Running across him, didn't he say that? Not to be corny, love infused his work and infused his writing.
Oh, his mantra to his very last breath was: do what you love and love what you do. He believed that love was the rocket fuel in his booster rocket, if you will, that propelled his career. He always said, everything is love. He sent his books to film director John Huston in the late 40s and early 50s. Why? Because he loved the films of John Huston. He wrote science fiction and fantasy and horror because he loved reading that as a child. He always followed his passions. He wrote stories as a great adult literary master about dinosaurs because he loved dinosaurs. Yet those stories were much more than just simply dinosaur mm-hmm. stories. He was, again, using his childhood loves as a way to reflect on larger issues. He would tell you if he was with us right now that the operating word in his entire existence is quite simply love.
Hmm. David is calling from Williamsville, New York. Welcome to On Point, David.
Hey there, Jackie, Sam, and Gary. I wanted to comment on Bradbury didn't seem to dwell too much on science as part of his science fiction. He had a real poignancy towards the living condition of creatures. And, for instance, the Martians in the Martian Chronicles were not boogeymen. He was very compassionate. Also, they didn't have ray guns that would dispose of the human beings. They shot bees out of a conical-shaped weapon. So he really didn't seem to worry too much about the technical aspects of the science, but more he had a poignancy, a real compassion for the characters, whether they were alien or human.
Okay, thank you for that, David. Let's take another call on the Martian Chronicles. Didn't mean to step on you there, but let's stick with that for a bit. Sarah is calling from Mooresville, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, Sarah.
Hi, Jackie. I just wanted to comment on a scene that really stuck with me about the Martian Chronicles. One of the chapters opens with a Martian housewife in her house, and it goes on to describe the house itself and how it's sentient, how she can control it, how it will come to envelop them when they want to sleep, and some of the finer details kind of escape me.
Maybe her bed rises from the floor, the pillars cook things. They're pulling everything they need from the living, breathing walls. It's beautiful. So your comment is that this is a sort of a beautiful element, Sarah, or?
Yes, it just really stuck with me the way he described the house and how he just thought of that, and that's how a Martian house would be. I was fascinated by that.
Thank you. You know, how would a Martian house be, Sam Weller? I mean, is he saying this is how a Martian house should be, or is he saying really there are no walls at all?
Wow, this is opening a Pandora's box, the concept of Ray Bradbury's science, and then this question about what should a Martian house be. Ray would say, you know, he didn't care about science. He cared about compassion and the heart and storytelling. his visions of Mars, I think, came from the Victorian era, you know, discoveries of canals on Mars. In many ways, I think Bradbury, you know, was a progenitor of the steampunk movement, which is sort of re-embraced Victorian technology or, you know, late 1800s technology or what have you. And I think his Martian Chronicles is the landscape is very, very singular. It's very much his own. The hills are blue. They're not red. You don't need helmets to breathe the air. The houses are made of crystal. It's a very, very original envisioning. There was a book signing he did a few years back where a child came up to him and said, "Mr. Bradbury, I love you, but you're Mars. It's impossible. There are two moons and people can breathe." And Ray Bradbury looked at the young boy and smiled and said, "If I didn't love you so much, I'd tell you to go to hell."
Well, I wanted what a Martian house should be a very open-ended question, by the way. And I like what you're saying. Yes. I mean, we know that Neil Gaiman really, really loved Bradbury novels, but also, you know, the steampunk movement. I was thinking there's, you know, Tim Burton owes him a debt. I mean, lots of people who've made the sort of fantastical macabre a place you want to enter.
I think he invented worlds in the way a fantasy writer does, and he was not as ignorant of science as people sometimes say. He knew perfectly well that the real Mars, even in 1950, he knew that the real Mars was uninhabitable. But it was a convenient metaphor. One of the wisest writers of science fiction, Samuel Delaney, talked about science fiction providing a means of literalizing metaphors. He wanted to create a house that's an embracing house. And he set it on Mars because it was the Mars of his imagination. Interestingly, later in life, he became a champion of the space program. He was not anti-technology his entire career. He was very excited about the Apollo program.
If I could add a funny footnote there, you know, Ray Bradbury never drove an automobile. He saw a car accident in 1934 that so scarred him that he refused to ever operate a car. Yet just a few years back, he was invited out to Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Pasadena. And the scientists said, "Mr. Bradbury, is it true you've never driven?" And he said, "Why, yes, it is." And they handed him a laminated license, driver's license they had made for Mars. And then all of a sudden, a giant screen came up. A giant screen came up, and they were looking live at the surface of Mars from a camera on the Mars rover, and they handed Ray Bradbury a device similar to a joystick on a video game, and Ray Bradbury drove the Mars rover on Mars. So he's never driven here on Earth, but he did operate the Mars rover on Mars.
Oh, I love that. And hey, guys, Sam and Gary, thanks for not correcting me, Neil Gaiman. You know, speaking of Mars, we have a lovely clip here. Bradbury's 1948 short story, Mars is Heaven, adapted into an episode of Ray Bradbury Theater in 1990. And in this story, a group of astronauts lands on Mars, and they're surprised to find that the place resembles our own hometowns, complete with our friends, family, lovers.
Captain, I know this place. It's Grinnell, Iowa.
Greentown, Illinois. I got it.
Miss Henley?
We miscalculated. Circle round. Landed back on Earth.
We've traveled 300 million miles, tracked by telemetry every inch of the way. There was no miscalculation.
I just loved that whole concept, that they travel all this way and it's back to where they began.
Or at least they think it is.
They think
the story
it is.
Unfolds. It's
yes.
A little bit.
Greentown's proliferate.
Well, Greentown is everywhere. Greentown is on Mars. There's a version of Greentown on Venus. There's a version of Greentown in Ireland. I mean, we keep coming back to Dandelion Wine, but I keep thinking also that one of the keynotes of Bradbury's entire career was what happens in that novel. And the way he describes it, if you call it a novel, certainly a collection of stories and sketches, is 1928, summer of 1928, is when Douglas Spalding discovered he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And Bradbury's entire corpus is about discovering that you're alive.
Because, Gary, wasn't his Greentown Waukegan, Illinois, if we're going to be, and I think he would hate for me to be this specific, but it was, right?
You can still see the ravine from Dandelion Wine. You can visit it in Waukegan. I was up there a couple of weeks ago, and it's very much still, you can still see the Ray Bradbury town there.
Mm-hmm. Also, Something Wicked This Way Comes, I think, is set there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he was not shy about saying that the Greentown was a rechristened Waukegan. It was a mythical version of his childhood home, and it was really his opportunity to reflect on idyllic small-town Americana and analyze the different themes that would occur in that, whether it's Greentown on Mars or Greentown circa 1928.
Let's take a quick call here. David, calling from Boston. You're welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you. I, too, came to Bradbury through Dandelion Wine, and I, too, sent him a love letter regarding that book, and I, too, received a handwritten response. But I was fortunate enough to also be given a label for a bottle of Dandelion Wine signed by Ray Bradbury. But what I take away from Bradbury as a creator is that he could encompass mankind. He could encompass our evil and our great good and joy, and he could then turn around and put that on paper and share with the rest of us.
Well, thank you for that sip of a recollection, David. Has anyone ever tasted any Dandelion Wine?
Bradbury had several bottles in his refrigerator, and it was quite nasty.
I thought it was – I had some, too. It's ridiculously sweet, and it's – I don't know. It's awful.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about author Ray Bradbury, who passed away at age 91 this week. And we're joined this hour by Sam Weller, biographer of Ray Bradbury. His upcoming anthology is called Shadow Show, All New Stories in Celebration of Ray Bradbury. And also by Gary Wolfe, science fiction editor and critic. And his latest book is called Evaporating Genres, Essays on Fantastic Literature. And let's take some calls here on Point. Tim is calling in from Dover, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Tim.
Hi, Jackie. There's been a lot of discussion about the science fiction and the politics, which are marvelous in his books, but it was the humanity in his stories that always kept me coming back. I discovered the short stories when I was in elementary school, R is for rocket and S is for space, and I loved the imagination, but there was always this human element that really touched me deeply. And I remember especially in Something Wicked This Way Comes, I think it is, where it starts out and it's a 12-year-old boy and it's the first day of summer. And the the summer is just stretching out forever beyond him. And I just remember connecting so powerfully with that, and just felt like the story was written for me and about my life, and I was in the story. And that really was just an amazing piece of his writing, I think.
Thank you so much for that, Tim. Let's take another call here. Denise is calling from Manchester, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Denise.
Hi, Jackie. I was, no longer am, a career bookseller for 33 years. And one of the things that I always did every September, as all of you booksellers and librarians know, is Banned Books Month. And one of the major books that we had in our display was Fahrenheit 451, because censorship is anathema to all of us. So I just would like to thank Ray Bradbury for bringing that to the fore, and I'm really glad that I got to put his book in a center place in my banned book displays, and I thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Thank you for that call, Denise. Sam, you know, I was in prepping for this hour, I came across Vroman's bookstore, an independent bookstore in L.A. I'm sure you know it, said that
yes.
Even this year, so far this year, it has sold hundreds of copies of Fahrenheit 451 and other books by Ray Bradbury. I mean, it's astonishing to think of the speed at which these books still fly off the shelf. And, of course, now I'm sure they will even more.
That book was published in October of 1953 and currently sells more copies than it's ever sold in its entire print run history. I think Gary could comment on, you know, its connection perhaps to contemporary society from a scholarly point of view. But, you know, Bradbury wrote that book in 9 days on a timed typewriter in the basement of the UCLA library for $9.80 in dimes. And it continues to have this transcendence in connection to contemporary society. And I think one of the callers made a really astute point as we sit here and talk about the themes and the contemporary issues that Bradbury was reflecting upon in his fictions. It is very, very important to say that while he was doing all of that, he certainly was writing about the human heart and the human condition. And I think that's what elevated his work beyond just cold ruminations on social satire or what have you. Bradbury was saying something about compassion and humanity, and always his stories made people feel less lonely. They certainly were in my life. My mother died of cancer, and when I was 24, and I remember reading one of his books on a winter night, and I felt less alone during that time because of the words of Ray Bradbury.
That's a beautiful story.
I think Fahrenheit 451 is also one of those books that keeps coming back around. I mean, for decades now, and it's been in high schools for decades. Everybody can name the classic dystopian novels, and the ones you think of are 1984, Brave New World, and Fahrenheit 451. And maybe in another 10 years, The Handmaid's Tale will join that. Maybe in another 20 years, The Hunger Games will. But here we are with a top-grossing movie, which is a dystopia for young adults. And, of course, people are going to go back and look at the classic dystopia for young adults. And that's something else I would say about Bradbury, is that, you know, he was never classified as a young adult writer, and yet I don't think there's a thing he wrote that that doesn't appeal to adolescents.
If I could add, the first time I interviewed him, he told me, you know what my secret is, I'm a children's writer. So that that validates Gary's statement right there. Mm. He said that his ideas appealed to children. You know, he was, I think, I travel the country speaking about him, and he is the great gateway author. He helps children who like The Hunger Games and Twilight and Harry Potter. He ushers them over to literature, because Bradbury didn't just study genre. He studied Faulkner and Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Eudora Welty and Willa Cather, and he took everything he learned from them and then brought it over to fantasy and science fiction. So he's this tremendous gateway author to helping young readers discover literature.
Okay. Let's take another call here. Rob is calling from San Diego. Welcome to On Point, Rob.
Hi there, Jackie. I just had an experience that I want to relate that I had when I was taking a short story writing course at UCLA. In fact, I probably used the same typewriter he did in the basement of the
library. Wow, aren't you lucky?
Oh,
but anyway, I was taking a short story writing course at night, and the instructor said, well, go to any bookstore and get a book on how to write. So I went to a bookstore in Beverly Hills, and I was looking through the shelves there where they had the section on how to write books and so on. And I was picking up one, and I heard a voice behind me, and it said, buy the art of dramatic writing. He says, I based my entire career on this book. This was a voice behind me. I didn't see who it was, so I turned around, and my thinking was, who are you, you know, to tell me about this, your entire career, et cetera. And he said, hi, my name's Ray Bradbury. Taken aback, you know, it's unbelievable. So we got talking a lot, and the guy's amazing, just amazing. Wow. Anyway, I said, well, maybe you'd like to come and be a guest speaker at this course. And so he said, I'd love to. So anyway, he came and became a guest speaker for one night at the short story writing course.
Oh, that's a great story, Rob. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's fantastic. Let's take another call here. Lisa is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Welcome to On Point, Lisa.
Hi, Jackie. I have my own story in L.A. is that he spoke at my college, and he said that when he was young, they had a carnival come to town, and the magician was there on stage, and he was in front, and he waved his wand around and said, you're going to do something great, and touched him right in the nose, Ray Bradbury, right in the nose, and gave him a great big electric shock. And he said, I had to do something great after that. I'd been electrified.
Thank you, Lisa.
Mr. Electrico, tell us about that, Sam.
Well, it was Labor Day weekend, 1932, on the shoreline of Lake Michigan, and Mr. Electrico looked at young Ray Bradbury and cried, live forever. And Ray Bradbury said, gee, that's a great idea. How do you do that? And 2 weeks later, he started writing, and he never stopped.
Well, he had an absolutely great run. 91, not shabby. Another call here. Catherine is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Welcome to On Point, Catherine.
Hi, Jackie and Sam and Gary. How are you?
Great.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, when I was a teenager, I had already read, I believe, Dandelion Wine and Fahrenheit 451, and then I found the short story, The Pedestrian, which kind of blew my mind. I mean, I loved all of the stuff by Bradbury, but that story in particular resonated with me. It was published in 1951, I found out, and so it's dystopian in the way that a lot of his books are, mm-hmm. and stories, but it's also kind of a warning, maybe a shot across the bow for the environmental movement, because it's about this guy who lives in the suburb and walks everywhere and disdains the car, and everybody is driving and watching their big screens, and he just sees the glow from outside their windows, and he gets I believe he gets arrested for walking.
The police pick him up, yeah.
Yeah, it's
well, right. I'm so glad you mentioned that story. This is one of the things that can happen with Bradbury stories, that they become a part of your life. And every time – and I'm not kidding. Every time I find myself walking alone in the suburb and I'm the only one on the sidewalk, I look around to see if there's a police car there because I'm thinking of the pedestrians.
Huh. Interesting. Well, and sometimes there is. Let's sneak in one more call. Ken is calling – and depending on your suburb. Ken is calling from Clarksville, Tennessee.
Hi, Ken? Jackie.
Hi. Just quickly, Ken, please.
I just want to say my favorite Ray Bradbury short story is There Will Come Soft Rains, about the robotic house. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It survives the nuclear war. Also, why couldn't there be an artificial atmosphere on Mars that people could breathe?
Why not?
Something like sulfur chloride, you know.
All right, Ken, thank you. Thank you so much. I think everyone has just you know what I'm really noticing? Everybody has a moment that really just limns for them what this has been. And I thought we're also talking about someone who loved the written word. And I didn't want to end without hearing Ray Bradbury read a poem. And on the eve, we were speaking before about the space program, on the eve of the Mariner 9 spacecraft going into orbit around Mars in 1971, Bradbury took part in a symposium at Caltech along with Arthur C. Clarke, Carl Sagan, and others, and he read his poem, If Only We Had Taller Been.
Short man, large dream, I send my rockets forth between my ears, hoping an inch of good is worth a pound of years. Aching to hear a voice cry back along the universal mall, we've reached Alpha Centauri. We're tall. Oh, God, we're tall.
Wow. Wow. Sam, Gary?
It was... It was the same kind of enthusiasm for the future. I guess one of the things that we tend to overlook is that he had a genuine technological optimism on the one hand. Mentioning of a story like There Will Come Soft Rains, there was the other side too. He was very concerned about nuclear holocaust, about this is what happens at the end of the Martian Chronicles, and it's very frightening.
Well, Gary, thanks so much for joining us. And Sam Weller, the same to you. Both our guests have been with us from Chicago. Sam, what are you going to do over the weekend when you think about Ray Bradbury? Any special ceremony, moment?
Well, I'm traveling to Los Angeles over the weekend to visit with his family and memorialize him. But just reflect on how much he gave to the universe, and truly the universe gave back to him 91 beautiful years of life.
Thank you ever so much, both of you. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you. Game of Thrones, actor Peter Dinklage. You may know him as Tyrion Lannister. He inspires Bennington's college class of 2012. This is On Point. So last Friday, Emmy Award-winning actor Peter Dinklage of HBO's Game of Thrones inspired Bennington College graduates with his own story of success. After graduating deep in debt in 1991, that'll sound familiar to many today, he took a job he didn't like and put his dreams of acting aside until he just couldn't do it anymore. He talked about his loft in Brooklyn that lacked heat but still had its charms.
I did have hot water. Hot water in my bathroom. Which a friend of mine, using said bathroom, once shouted, "It smells exactly like a summer camp in here." It was true. For some reason, in the middle of Brooklyn, there was earth in my shower. Actual earth. And then, oh look, mushrooms growing from the earth. But I was safe, though. The Ideal Fire Control Company was right across the street where they make all the chemicals that put out chemical fires. I did not fear a chemical fire. I would be okay. And all those chemicals in the air were okay too, because up the street we had the spice factory. They made spices. And that just covered everything up in a nice cumin scent. I had a rat, but that was okay because I got a cat. His name was Brian, no relation. My grandmother had given me a pink pull-out couch. Oddly, no friends or recent graduates wanted to crash on my couch. So I put the couch on its end so Brian could climb it and look out the window. I had only the one window. I myself could not look out the window. It was quite high. So I had no heat, no girlfriend. What, are you kidding me? No acting agent. But I had a cat named Brian, who told me of the world outside. And I stayed for 10 years. No, don't pity me. There's a happy ending. When I was 29, I told myself, the next acting job I get, no matter what it pays, I will, from now on, for better or worse, be a working actor. So I quit my position at the Professional Examination Services. My friends really weren't happy about that because it was so easy to find me when I worked there. Work was the only place I had the internet. This was at the beginning of the internet. And now I didn't have either the internet or a cell phone or a job. But something good happened. I got a low-paying theater job in a play called Imperfect Love. which led to a film called 13 Moons with the same writer, which led to other roles, which led to other roles. And I've worked as an actor ever since. But I didn't know that would happen. At 29, walking away from data processing, I was terrified. 10 years in a place without heat, 6 years at a job I felt stuck in. Maybe I was afraid of change. Are you?
Emmy Award-winning actor Peter Dinklage speaking to 2012 graduates at Bennington College in Vermont last Friday. To see a video of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, who's back next week, and this is On Point.